Madame André. Chaudaigu Plateau, Cantal, France. March 21, 1944. Once again, I wake up in the backseat of Dennis Rake's little Renault. It is hard, grueling work that we've gotten ourselves into, and I am exhausted, what with keeping our radios on hand at all hours to listen for transmissions on the BBC French service, and being up all night waiting for the drops at various airfields, then cleaning the weapons of grease and packing materials. We've been doing this for 3 weeks now, and my muscles ache. My fingers are dirty and numb. I'd exchange one of my lesser organs, say an ovary, for a jar of cold cream and a hot bath. There is a natural hot springs near Chaudaigu where we can bathe, but it requires use of a vehicle to get there and several spare hours, so we go only once a week. Most of the Marquis just rinse off in the creek as necessary, which means I have to go upstream each morning to perform my necessary ablutions. Sleep, when I'm able to get it, is like falling into a deep, dark cavern that swallows me whole. Denden's Renault is a better option than the ground beside the fire. I stay a bit drier this way, and it allows me enough privacy to sleep in one of the two nightgowns I've brought with me. But it's hard to stretch out in the back seat, and all the little muscles along my spine and down the back of my legs seize up during the night. They complain at any sudden movement. Each day I wake missing my bed with its proper mattress. I miss Picon. I miss Henri most of all. But there is work to do, and I must get after it. No time to sit around feeling maudlin. So I pull on my clothing beneath the mangy blanket I've acquired from one of the Makisar, cursing once again all the various contraptions required to function as a woman. This tiny, inadequate space is the only privacy I have, and I am determined to find a better solution.
Madame André, we have a problem, Fournier says, finding me a short time later at the creek.
I am brushing my teeth and tucking the craziest strands of my untrimmed hair beneath my beret. I sigh and spit toothpaste into a gorse bush.
Of course we do. Come with me, he says.
Fournier leads me back up the hill to the clearing, where a young Frenchman stands beside the fire. He is tall and thin, with a nice jaw, but his pretty eyes are pinched in exquisite pain. A dirty bandage is wrapped around his left hand, and blood seeps through the cloth. I nod at the young man, but do not smile. These poor boys take even a half-hearted grin as an invitation to flirt, and given that my left hand is bare, none of them know that I am married. Not that it would do much good anyway.
This is Louis, Fournier tells me. He blew 3 fingers off his hand with a grenade yesterday.
Louis holds up the bandaged knob as proof.
Why the bloody hell did you do that? I ask him.
Louis looks so mortified you'd think that I had caught him in the act of pleasuring himself. Fournier digs the toe of his boot into a patch of charred ground near the fire.
Most of my men do not know how to use the weapons. They are tradesmen, factory workers mostly, men who fled our cities during the relève so they wouldn't be drafted into working for the Germans. These men, our Makisar, are not traditional soldiers.
Thus our problem, I guess. Fournier nods. This is his most frequent form of communication, and I have learned to read each little bob of his head for subtleties.
We need someone to train the groups in weapons use, he says. We have to be prepared if the Germans attack.
When, I correct him. It's likely to happen sooner rather than later, unless we strike first. There are 22,000 Germans garrisoned throughout the Auvergne and Cantal, and they know that something has changed within the Marquis structure, not the least of which is that the resistance is acquiring weapons from an unknown source. So they have increased the number and range of their daily patrols. They are harassing the local villages more often, sometimes to the point of unspeakable violence. Our scouts indicate that the Germans are suspicious and looking for resistance leaders. They are looking for a fight. And we can't have our men blowing themselves up before the fight even arrives. I turn to Louis and study him closely. He can't be more than 23 years old.
Are you married? I ask.
The stupid boy cannot help himself.
Who knows how long he's been out here in these woods? Even his pain cannot overrule his biology. He looks me over head to toe and then back again. He smirks.
For now.
Gah, Frenchman. I roll my eyes. I would think a married man would be more careful with his hands, I say. Now go find someone to take you to Chaudaigu so you can see a doctor before the rest of it rots off. I motion for Fournier to follow me, and we leave Louis standing there, bandages pressed against his chest, looking for all the world like he's just been chastised by an irascible schoolmarm. Fournier chuckles as we turn into the woods and onto a path that has been beaten down by countless footsteps.
Do you have children? He asks.
No. He gives me one of his nods. There is no pity in it, nor sympathy, just understanding.
Neither do I.
This surprises me, and I tell him as much.
My wife and I are unable to. I have come to think of these young men as the children I did not get.
He gives me a sideways look, followed by a crooked grin.
They like you.
I snort. A bit too much, perhaps. He shrugs.
They have been out here for a long while, but they are not dead. So that part is inevitable. What I mean is that they are willing to be led by you. It took me nearly a year to gain their trust, but you have done it in weeks.
You're the one who leads them. I only boss them around occasionally.
And yet, they do what you tell them.
Only because I threatened to shoot their balls off if they didn't.
Well, they are not entirely stupid.
Fournier stomps through the undergrowth after me. Though I could easily debate him on that point, I change the subject. Tell me what you know about the man they call Soutine.
Gabriel Soutine?
He scratches his chin for a moment as we work our way around a fallen log.
He is a local partisan leader. He lives in the village of Terme.
Is it true that he monitors the German troop movements throughout the region? Fournier looks at me curiously.
Where did you hear this?
I point to the sky, from whence comes most of our information. London.
Ah, well, yes. If anyone knows where the Germans are and how many, it would be Soutine.
Will he talk to us, do you think, Hubert and me?
I am sure he would be willing to barter information for supplies.
At this, I get one of Fournier's rare smiles.
You are a very powerful woman, Madame André. Word has gotten out.
Let's just hope word doesn't get to the wrong ears. The last thing I need is anyone associating the White Mouse with Madame André. Hellfire will rain down on us the moment that connection is made by the Germans. We will pay Soutine a visit later today.
I will send word, he says. But where are we going now?
To find Denden? Fournier looks at the sky. The sun has barely risen.
I imagine he's still sleeping.
Oh, I'm certain he is. Dennis Rake is up half the night operating his transmitter and listening to the radio. And then, of course, there are the airdrops. None of us are exempt when those are scheduled. So he has created his own quiet space in the woods to retreat from Fournier's rowdy Frenchman, and the Marquis generally let him be. They understand that if he's not alert enough to work the transmitter, no one gets their supplies. Dennis has erected a small lean-to for himself beneath a giant pine tree in the woods. He has quite cleverly used shipment crates and parachutes to build the small waterproof dwelling. It's so clever, in fact, that many of Fournier's men have begun doing the same, and I am often put upon to settle quarrels about who can abscond with the packing materials once the weapons have been cleaned and distributed. A low rumble drifts from the lean-to as we approach. Denden, I say, louder than necessary, and then as Fournier steps forward to shove aside the tent flaps, add, I wouldn't do that if I were you.
Why?
He sleeps naked. Fournier jumps back as though the tent flaps were vipers ready to strike. How? Long story that takes place in Scotland and involves myself, Denden, and a rubber ducky. His eyes narrow.
Do you mean to say that the two of you are...
Absolutely not! I am tempted to add that I am married and Dennis Rake is a homosexual, but that is personal information that could be used against us should it ever fall into the wrong hands. I pick up a small rock and toss it toward the tent. Den Den! A snort, a groan, and then a thump as Rake tries to sit up and whacks his head against one of the wooden slats. What? A pause. Damn it, that hurt. Get up. I'd rather not just yet if it's all the same to you. I need you to take notes. I am not your secretary, Ducky. Find someone else. Ah, but you are my radio man, and I need to make additions to the list of supplies you'll request tonight. He yawns. Run out of toothpaste, have you? No, but I could use some face cream, so that will go on your list, along with a bit of tea. That was my deal with Buckmaster. I get into France and get situated with the Marquis, and I will be allowed to request personal items. But the real reason I need you to get your skinny ass out of bed is because Fournier's men are out there blowing off bits of themselves in the woods. Bully for them. So it's time we put in a request for Anselm. The lean-to goes very quiet at this. Then, after a few seconds, Rake shoves aside the tent flaps and sticks his head out. The man looks as though he's been electrocuted in his sleep, hair going everywhere, and I want to crack a joke about newborns and birth canals. But he's grinning like a madman, and I don't want to disrupt his sudden good humor. Why didn't you just say so? In the end, Hubert and I decide to visit Soutine alone. It takes over an hour as we pick our way north through back roads near Montluçon. We thought about taking Fournier, but we do not know when the Germans will strike, and it would be unwise to leave the Marquis without their leader. We are on the outskirts of Termes when we see the blockade. Stretched across the road is a Nazi Wehrmacht bus, one of the transport vehicles used to bring soldiers into France. It is parked at such an angle that no traffic can get through from either direction. On the other side of the blockade is the village of Termes, where, according to Fournier, we will find Gabriel Soutine. The village is set on a low hill overlooking vast pasture land. It is as lovely and picturesque as any French town I've ever seen. But today, there is something desperately wrong. Pull off the road, now, I tell Hubert, and he swerves onto the shoulder beside a low fence meant to keep sheep and goats off the road. I can feel him stiffen in the seat beside me, and I know he's reaching for his gun. Do you see anyone? I ask. No. Hubert rolls down the driver's side window and listens. He shakes his head. Nothing. I'll go check. Are you crazy? He asks. Many people think so, I say, digging around in my purse. I fish out my red lipstick, apply a fresh coat, then flash him a disarming smile. I'll be right back. The thing I like most about Hubert is that he doesn't argue with me. No doubt he finds me endlessly trying, but he lets me do what I think is best. I tuck my revolver into my waistband at the small of my back and cover it with the edge of my blouse, and I'm out of the car, creeping toward the bus. Bonjour, I ask. Anyone there? We're just needing to get through. No answer. The bus is parked several hundred feet from our Renault, stretched across the road at a 45-degree angle with its nose pointing in the opposite direction. Anyone there? I call again and lift my hands, palms out, to show I mean no harm. But once again, I am greeted by silence. Closer now, I peer under, but see no one. I knock on the door and push it open. Completely empty. The bus has four rows of seats, and then at the back, two long benches that face each other. I assume that this is where the brown shirts store their machinery, but a quick glance under the benches shows nothing. Whatever they brought with them, they have taken into the village. If packed to capacity, the bus can hold about 30 people. I step outside and move toward the rear just to be safe. No one. We just want to get home, I call, giving Hubert a look over my shoulder. I shake my head. It's obvious the bus has been parked here, but it's strange that no one has been left to guard it. I am walking back to convene with Hubert and see if he has any ideas what we should do, when the sharp metallic sound of a whistle cuts through the air. It is followed by three more, then a single gunshot. A cascade of horrified screams drifts up from the village on the hill, followed by coarse, guttural shouting. Another shot, and all is silent except for a single, indecipherable German voice that seems to be giving orders. I hurl myself toward the car as Hubert puts it in reverse. The road is narrow, and he has to make a 5-point turn before he's able to get the little Renault pointed in the other direction. Neither of us speaks for a good 10 seconds, but I know we're both thinking the same thing. We have to help them, I say. Yes, Hubert answers. He has spoken a grand total of 10 words since we left the encampment, but he offers an 11th now. Soutine. I hope not. Why else would the Germans be in this little village? Hubert drives a short distance in the opposite direction, far enough to round a sharp bend before he pulls the Renault to the side once again. There's a bit more shoulder on this stretch of road, along with patches of gorse brush, so we hide the car and formulate our plan. Do you have your binoculars? He asks. In my pack. Grab them. We can approach Terme from here, but we'll have to go through the pasture. Hubert's revolver is strapped to his leg, so his hands are free as we scramble through the waist-high grass. There's a flush to his cheeks, and I am reminded that my partner is first and foremost a soldier. Somewhere in the village, a small child begins to scream. It's the kind of sound that can make your knees go out from under you. It can twist your stomach into a boiling mass of bile. It can stop your heart. It is the sound of soul-ripping terror. A German soldier shouts. A lone woman is wailing, grief and fear penetrating every note of her voice. And we are running as quietly and quickly as we can toward Terme. Like something from a fairy tale, the entire village is surrounded by a low, stacked stone wall covered in budding vines. It is roughly 3 feet tall and looks as though it will be buried in honeysuckle blooms within days. But the continuing, traumatized shrieks of that child indicate that what's happening within resembles something from a nightmare. We push through the last section of pasture and come to an abrupt stop behind the wall. We ready ourselves, then peer over the edge, between two stucco buildings, into the center of the village. Like many old French hamlets, it is a cluster of shops and homes built around an open central area, something like a town square, only much smaller. It appears as though the entire village is gathered there, watching something. Hubert goes over the wall first, and I follow close behind. Then we ease between the two buildings until we reach the edge of the crowd, where an old man leans hard against the wall. Hubert sets his hand on the man's shoulder, and he physically recoils. He must be nearing the age of 90. His spine is bent, his hair is gone, and his eyes have the milky look of one going blind. "What is going on here?" Hubert whispers gently in French. The old man hangs his head.
"You are too late."
"Too late for what?"
"To save her."
"Who?"
"Olivia Soutine," he says.
The crowd sways back and forth, and only then do I realize that they are weeping silently, grasping one another for strength. Most of them look at their feet or at the sky, anywhere but the village center. It takes a moment to find the woman chained to the light post. Her arms are stretched taut above her, her head hangs to her chest at an unnatural angle, and her entire torso is split open from throat to groin. At her feet, in a ghastly pool of blood and entrails, lies her unborn child, a full-size infant ready to be born. To her left stands a little girl, her daughter, no more than 2 years old, shrieking and crying like a tiny wounded animal, eyes red, nose running, chest heaving. Her arms are raised to the mother who will never hold her again. And to Olivia Soutine's left is the brown shirt who slaughtered her, dripping bayonet raised above his head.
"Jesus, God in heaven,"
Hubert whispers, his voice stretched thin by the agony of prayer.
"Help."
After a moment, the toddler looks around and sees an old woman with silver hair and a face creased like worn linen. The little girl stumbles toward her, arms outstretched, desperate, begging to be held against that ample bosom. But the old woman turns her away, visibly shaken, as she denies the deepest instinct of any woman, much less one her age. The soldiers pace, waiting, ready, almost eager.
"They will not let anyone help the child," the old man whispers. "They threaten to shoot anyone who does. 24 hours we must leave Olivia there before she can be buried. The child can be taken in at sunset. If we touch them before that, they will shoot all the children in the village and throw their bodies in the well so we can never retrieve them."
I rise up on my tiptoes to peer over the crowd. Only then do I see that the old man is telling the truth. All the village children have been brought to the front, where desperate parents cling to them and cover their eyes.
"Why did they do this?"
I ask, but I do not recognize my own voice. It is hollow and tremulous. He tries to explain.
"The garrison commander at Montluçon came looking for her husband, Gabriel. His men blockaded the road on both sides of the village, then went house to house searching for him. But all they could find were his wife and daughter."
He nods toward the light post, and I feel a wave of nausea rising in my belly.
"Once they had her chained, they forced everyone out of their homes to watch. The German officer in charge asked her 3 times where her husband was, but she refused him each time. And all the while, her daughter stood there, eyes wide, sucking her thumb. I could see even from here that Olivia tried to be brave. She kept her voice steady so as not to scare the child. The officer gave her a 4th chance, but when she refused once more, he screamed. I have never heard a grown man make such a noise. And then he gave the order for her to be..."
He gulps.
"For his man to do that."
Rage is an odd thing, not so different from grief in the way it catches you unaware and then explodes in your chest. It crashes against you like a wave, and all I can think in this moment is that we are sitting here watching this happen, doing nothing.
"We have to stop them," I hiss.
"No."
The old man looks at me, and I am ashamed suddenly because his eyes reflect pity.
"You need to leave, while you still can."
Hubert sets his hand between my shoulder blades and leans close to whisper. "There are nearly 30 soldiers in this village, all of them heavily armed with rifles and bayonets. The villagers number little more than 100, and they have nothing. If we move, if we act at all, they will open fire on those children." He points toward Olivia Soutine's child. "And they will start with that little girl."
"So we do nothing?"
"They came for Soutine. They came to make a point. They do not want anyone else," the old man says.
There are some things that little eyes can never unsee, some moments that no mind, no matter how young or resilient, can ever forget. For the little girl beside the light post, this will be one. She has gone into shock now. Her tears have ceased, and she drops to the ground beside her dead mother, stupefied. I lift my binoculars from where they hang on the cord around my neck and inspect the village. Hubert is right. There is 1 soldier for every 3 villagers, and they all carry rifles affixed with bayonets. I know that I am a coward, but I keep my gaze away from the light post. I cannot bear to see that woman again. I cannot bear to see the face of her child up close. I do not want to know the color of her eyes, because it will henceforth be associated with slaughter. So I scan the crowd instead, and I bear witness to the shock and horror on their tear-streaked faces. Hands over mouths, eyes squeezed shut, chests that heave with silent tears, unmitigated fury and despair beyond words. Some are frozen, others are shaking. More than one young woman and old man has fainted. The old woman who turned the child away has collapsed into the arms of a man beside her. And then I see the face. His face, that face made of spare parts and pure hatred, so unique and ghoulish it cannot be mistaken. Obersturmführer Wolf. He has stepped from the shadows of a building to oversee his handiwork, walking a lazy circle around the light post as he nods. Wolf speaks in a low voice, so I cannot hear what he says to the officer holding the bayonet, but he is clearly pleased with the work that has been done. I associate Wolf with that water wheel in Vienna, and my mind struggles to make sense of his presence here. But there is no mistaking him. The cruelty, the hatred, the whip. I don't even realize that I'm lunging forward, trying to push my way through the crowd until Hubert's arms are around me. He slams me against the nearest building, hard enough to knock the wind out of me. My grunt, mingled with stinging breath, comes out in an inaudible puff. "What are you doing? You're going to get us all killed," Hubert hisses. I'm gasping for air like a dying fish, and my head throbs from where it's hit the wall. All I can manage to spit out is a strangled whisper. "I've seen that man before." "I don't care," Hubert says, and there is no small amount of regret in his voice when he adds, "There is nothing we can do for these people." "No." I shake my head because speaking the word feels impossible. It feels like failure. "We need to leave," Hubert says. His voice is a low, steady thrum in my ear. "Now." How can we walk away without doing anything? I ask myself that over and over, even as we retreat. I feel like a failure, a traitor. But the tiny, rational voice at the back of my skull insists that Hubert is right. We accomplish nothing if we get these people killed, if we die ourselves. I let Hubert steady me as we crawl back over the wall and through the pasture toward the road, sick and shaken. He looks as though all the blood has been drained from his body. When we reach the car, we stand there for a moment, feeling helpless and guilty and disgusted with ourselves. Both of us are considering the odds and whether we could have killed the brown shirts without unleashing more hell on that poor village. "Oh God, that tiny child." I can't help it. I drop to my hands and knees and vomit. Everything I had for breakfast, weak tea, some biscuit, and then bile. When there is nothing left in my stomach, I dry heave while hot, furious tears flood my face. My throat burns. My face feels warm and my hands are cold, shaking. I feel betrayed by my own body, as though I have become the weakest version of myself. "Nance," Hubert says, so overwhelmed with emotion that he's unaware he has used my real name. "We have to go." I lift one hand and he helps me to my feet. I suck air in through my nose. I spit, then drag my hands down my face. I stand there, eyes watering, long enough to calm my stomach. My fear is gone now, my nausea fading. All I have left is rage. This impotence is an all-consuming fury. I cannot do anything to help. I am useless. But I want revenge. I look at the bus parked farther up the road. I have an idea. "Where the hell are you going now?" Hubert hisses after me as I march toward the blockade. I turn, looking at him over my shoulder, cheeks damp and voice raw. "I'm going to take that bus."
Nancy Grace Augusta Wake. Verdun's Restaurant, Marseille, January 7th, 1939. Henri brings me to this restaurant every time I'm in Marseille. I think it is partly to banish the memory of meeting his father,
but also because this place was ours first, and he does not want to relinquish its meaning to a man who persists in trying to separate us. So in a way, every meal that we enjoy within these warm paneled walls is a way of thumbing our noses at old man Fjoka. However, he is the last thing on my mind at this particular moment.
"Do you remember that night in Paris when you walked with me along the Seine?" he asks.
"Yes."
"There is something I didn't tell you that night."
There is a slight tremble of emotion in his voice, and I am intrigued. I have never heard him speak with anything but charm and authority.
"Do you remember how I found you at Luigi's with your colleagues?"
"Of course. I told you I'd be there, remember? I practically dared you to come." Henri nods, then covers my hand lightly with his. He brushes his thumb across my knuckles.
"I was so jealous," he says,
as though confessing to murder or burglary or some especially egregious fetish. "Of who?"
"Them. Your friends."
He waves his free hand in the air.
"That Frank fellow in particular."
I try not to laugh, but I cannot help myself. "Frank Gilmore? Whatever for?"
"Because it was obvious that you were there, Nancy. I envied the way they made you laugh, their easy acquaintanceship. The fact that you'd chosen them over me, that night at least. I watched you for several minutes before sending that drink, and I found myself consumed with the reality that I wanted you all to myself."
"Is that such a bad thing?" He averts his eyes for a moment, those dark lashes brushing his cheeks. And when he returns his gaze, there is an intensity I have never seen in them before.
"I still want you all to myself, but the wanting isn't the half of it. I love you with the entirety of my heart. Which is why I would like to know if you will be my wife."
Henri pulls a small red velvet box from his suit pocket and sets it on the white tablecloth. It stands out like a blood drop on snow, and I cannot look away. I stare at him, helpless. Our relationship has always been strange. The way we came together and the way we have stayed together long distance for over 2 years, scraping out pockets of time to travel back and forth from Marseille to Paris. Despite having me meet his father soon after we began dating, he has never pressed me for anything or set an expectation. We discovered almost immediately how much we enjoy each other's company, which is quite separate from being in love. Love is a choice. It is the active choosing of good for another person. But like? It is a gift, and it cannot be forced. The degree to which we like each other cannot be overstated. Though I won't deny that we fell fast and hard into love as well. We laugh at the same things, and he pretends to be long-suffering about my outspokenness, but I know it delights him. He is my match, and I am his, and we are both well aware of this. I am stunned that he has offered me a ring only because we have never once spoken of marriage, and I have always assumed that such conversations precede a proposal. But here I am, staring at a velvet box, clenching his hand so hard that our knuckles have turned white. Once again, I try to find the words, but they drift away before I can grab hold of them. He wants me all to himself. He wants me to be his wife. I have never thought of myself as the marrying type, the type to settle down or commit. I don't even own furniture, for Pete's sake.
"If you need more time."
"Yes," I say. And then, when I see the hopeful look on his face, hasten to add, "I need time. Just a little bit. I did not expect this. Damn words. Now they choose to tumble out, an unruly mess, and I am in danger of breaking his heart. "I'm so sorry. It's only that—"
"You do not have to apologize or explain," Henri says.
It is a great testament to his character that he does not get angry or defensive. He doesn't backtrack or pretend that what he's asked isn't important. He simply lowers his head in a gentle bow and then lifts my hand from the table and kisses my knuckles.
There is no hurry. I am not going anywhere. I would be happy to marry you first thing in the morning. But if you ask that I wait until we are bent of spine and silver of head, I will.
Then he calls for the waiter and orders a shockingly expensive bottle of champagne, as though we are celebrating. And perhaps we are. Commitment comes in many forms other than matrimony. But it isn't until he has paid the check and is helping me into my jacket that I notice the little red velvet box is no longer sitting on the table.
Marseille. Le Parc Valmet, January 14, 1939.
Come with me,
Henri says, pulling off the road and stopping his shiny new Renault beside a low, crumbling stone wall.
I want you to meet someone.
Not another one of your relatives, I hope. I give him a warning frown, but it's all for show.
No.
Henri laughs.
Someone else.
The hillside drops away sharply on the other side of the road, falling swiftly toward the Mediterranean, currently a bright and startling blue, and I stare at the water while he crosses around to my side of the car. I will never get over the staggering beauty of Marseille, even in January, the worst month known to man. Henri opens my door, helps me into my new red wool peacoat, and takes my hand. He leads me through the gate and down a long, winding gravel path.
Where are we?
Le Parc Valmet, he says.
It looks like a cemetery. I take in the old bare trees with tangled roots and long dark branches, the stone benches, the whispered hush that has settled about the place like a wool blanket.
Non, ma chère. It's a park, one of the oldest and smallest in Marseille. But it's the prettiest, I think. You cannot match the view.
He's right. Even if it hadn't been framed by the sea, the little park would be bursting with charm and dignity. The stone wall curves around the perimeter like a stream, offering visitors endless places to sit beneath the latent willows or stretch out in the sun. There are duck ponds, rose bushes, long gone dormant for winter, and footpaths meandering this way and that. Thankfully, there's not a gravestone in sight. It has been a week since Henri proposed, and he has not mentioned it again. He has, however, kept me busy. Every day we go on an excursion. We visit museums and art galleries. We take the train to the nearby countryside and eat at small family-owned restaurants that do not offer menus. He has taken me shopping and sailing and picnicking. And all the while, I have thought about his proposal. I know Henri can see that I am growing more comfortable with the idea of marriage. Sometimes I catch him smiling as he watches me.
This way, Henri says.
The path before us forks in half, and we go left, then down, and around a sharp curve, only to find a man sitting on a bench to the side of the path with a little dog in his lap. Henri leads me toward him.
And who is this? I ask, bending down to scratch the small dog, a wire-haired terrier just like Beagle.
I look up at the owner, expecting to discover a kindred spirit, and see that he's a short, broad man with a kind face and extraordinary, odd eyes. One is brown, and the other grey. Not blue or green like you'd expect with a mismatched pair, but grey, like one of the pebbles on the path beneath our feet. I feel at once as though he is measuring my soul for quality, and a chill runs up the back of my neck.
It's not my job to name her, the man says.
It's yours, Henri adds.
And when he sees the confusion on my face, he laughs. It's a booming, raucous sound, and a puffy bluebird startles from the branch above his head.
She belongs to you now.
The little dog barks as if to confirm this, and then she wags her tail, her entire body shivering with anticipation.
Mine?
I look back and forth between Henri and this man, delighted, and scoop her up to pull her close beneath my chin.
A wife for Picon, Henri says. Every gentleman should be so lucky as to marry the woman he loves.
His voice is thick with meaning, and the little Frenchman turns away, suddenly fascinated by something on the horizon. The tip of my nose is nearly frozen in this January air, but my ears grow warm. My face flushes. I clear my throat. Picon hasn't even met her yet. Henri shrugs as if this fact is unimportant.
No matter. He will love her. How could he not?
It's true. She is a lovely little thing. White with large brown patches like puddles of chocolate. Eyes as big and round and dark as the buttons on my coat. I turn to the little Frenchman.
Thank you, monsieur.
He tips his chin toward Henri.
Thank him. He's the one who arranged the sale.
But you had to part with her, and that must be terrible. She is perfect. I've only known her for a few moments, but I could never let her go. This pleases him. I hadn't thought of him as stiff, but his shoulders relax and those startling eyes soften. Whatever measuring he began earlier seems to be complete now, and he gives me a warm smile.
My daughters will be pleased to hear that. They raise the dogs and cry whenever I have to find them homes, but I do not think they will cry tonight.
I offer my hand.
I am so very pleased to meet you, Monsieur Fistole, he says.
Nancy Wake. He kisses the back of my hand.
Mademoiselle?
Fistole is the tram conductor here in Marseille. We have known one another for how many years is it now?
Henri says.
15.
His wife is the best cook in the city, and his daughter's the prettiest.
I have no idea whether Henri is telling the truth, but it is clear from the way that Fistole is beaming that he certainly believes this to be true. It makes me love him all the more. He smiles as though his daughters have just been declared the most beautiful in the entire world. I wonder whether they got his eyes, and if so, which color? Perhaps both? And would that be alarming or enchanting in the face of a little girl? I hope to find out one day. Thank you as well, I tell Henri, reaching up on my tiptoes to plant a kiss firmly on his lips.
What should I name her?
I'm sure you'll think of something, he says, then offers me a sheepish grin. Keeping her a secret was unbearable. I could hardly wait for you to arrive last week. That train takes 54 hours to get here. You should probably just move here and put me out of my misery.
He is looking at me pointedly, and I suspect he's trying to determine whether I noticed that last comment. I ignore him. There is a name I thought of once, and I lift her up and turn her about to determine if it fits. It does.
Her name is Grenadine, I say.
Fistole slides off the bench and looks up at me. I am startled once again to realize how short he is, just over 5 feet. But he gives me a grin and a nod.
I must be getting back to work, he says.
He sets a gentle kiss right on the end of her nose.
You be good for your new mistress, Grenadine.
We say our goodbyes, then watch Fistole meander down the path, whistling as he goes. What a delightfully strange little man, I say.
He likes you.
How on earth could you tell?
He let you have her. He does not hand over his daughter's dogs to people he does not like. I've known the man for 15 years, and I still had to convince him to sell me one. He interviewed me, asked about my intentions and how I planned to provide for her, where she would live and what she would eat. Felt as though I was asking for his blessing to marry one of his daughters. I damn near broke into a sweat.
I drop to the bench and curl Grenadine into the crook of my arm. I hope Picon loves his new friend, wife, lover, as much as I do already. And I'm not stupid. I know what Henri's doing, how he's trying to win me over. But I don't mind. All is fair in love and war, after all. Thank you, I say again. But this time it's a whisper, and I'm rather overcome. Henri settles onto the bench beside me, drapes one arm over my shoulder, leans close and whispers,
I would buy you this entire city if only to see the look you have in your eyes right now.
I don't need the city, Henri. I have you. And Picon.
And Grenadine, he adds. You have her now as well.
I excel at stopping errant thoughts. I can trap them and discard them as though disposing of a spider that has wandered onto my pillow. Errant thoughts are dangerous. They can give way to hope. And hope can upheave your entire life if it's left alone long enough to put down roots. Errant thoughts can make you unreasonable and sappy. But for one startling moment, it occurs to me that this is what it must feel like to have a real family. My father left us when I was 2. All 5 of my siblings are many years older than I am. My mother did well just to keep us all alive. And I left home while still a child. So, family has always been an odd and loose term for me. But this feels right. It feels good. And the thought is so pleasant. I am so hungry for it, in fact, that I cannot discard it. Yes, I tell Henri. He knows what I mean. I'm certain of that because his eyes flash bright. But he is cautious.
Yes, what?
I love you as well. And I will marry you.
I wait several long seconds to let him absorb my acceptance before adding,
on one condition.
Henri pulls away. I make him nervous when I say things like this. Which is?
That you let me choose my own wedding present.
His lip twitches into an amused grin.
Do I get any hints as to what you might want?
Not yet.
He looks as though I've told him that I require a feather or a bit of eggshell in order to be his bride. This clearly makes no sense to him, but he doesn't care.
Henri Fiocca heaves a great sigh of relief and reaches into his coat pocket to pull out the red velvet box. You've been carrying that around all week?
He gives me a mischievous grin.
I never knew when you might accept. I wanted to be ready.
He taps the box.
May I?
And then I am undone, blinking furiously. I clear my throat.
Yes.
Henri opens the box and lifts an exquisite ring from the padding. It has a simple gold band, and the center diamond looks to be almost 3 carats. It couldn't be more elegant or perfect, and my hand trembles as he slides it onto my finger.
Yes?
He asks once more, just to make sure. A firm nod.
Yes.
He takes a deep breath.
You have your condition, which I accept. But I have another request.
Oh dear, I'm not sure I can take anything else.
Henri lifts my newly decorated hand to his lips and kisses the ring gently. He closes his eyes.
I hate being apart from you. Will you please move to Marseille?
Paris.
Rue Sainte-Anne, second arrondissement.
Are you moving in with Henri Fiocca?
Stephanie asks the moment I open the door to my flat.
I didn't think you were the type.
I have been trying to contact her since I returned from Marseille a week ago, but she and Count Gonzalez have been in Spain on holiday. I finally got through this morning and told her that I'd be taking Le Train Bleu to Marseille today and would like to say goodbye before leaving Paris once and for all.
No.
I step back so she can enter.
I am not moving in with him, but I am moving to Marseille.
We hug, exchange kisses on each cheek.
Where will you live then?
She demands.
At the Hotel de l'Uvepe, until I find us a flat. Us?
Me, I say, and then grudgingly add, and Henri.
To live in together?
Once we are married, yes. I hold up my left hand and show her the ring that Henri placed there last week. I'd wanted to tell her in person. No letters, no phone calls. Stephanie grabs my hand and brings it close to her face to inspect the ring. She is smiling and crying at the same time.
She is the only woman I've ever met who could make such conflicting emotions look beautiful.
Aren't you happy for me? I ask.
She nods.
I am.
But?
I am sad for myself. You are leaving me.
She looks at me with those huge blue eyes, and I see genuine sorrow in them.
You are the only friend I have.
The Count
is a man,
she interrupts.
It is not the same.
I cannot argue. The friendships of women are strange and wonderful, fraught and irreplaceable. And yet I can't apologize for moving away to marry the man I love. So instead I ask, will you come visit me?
Of course.
And I will return to Paris, often, I promise. She thinks about this for a moment, weighing the likelihood of either happening, and tries a different tack.
What about your job?
The one where I work hard and paid little and get no credit? It takes an effort, but she manages to hide her smile. Even she knows this was a poor argument.
Oui, that one.
I've submitted my final article and my resignation to Milo. I no longer have a job.
Doesn't that bother you?
Stephanie asks. If I'm being honest, it's a relief. At this particular moment, I don't give a rat's ass about independence or careers. I just want to be with Henri. Of everything I've said, this makes the most sense to Stephanie. She wraps her arms around my neck, then kisses each of my cheeks again.
I did warn you about him.
We move to the small table beside the window and sit. The sun is out today, and it comes through the glass panes in bright, warm squares. Stephanie looks around my small kitchen, and I know she sees only a handful of boxes packed and ready to ship to Marseille. My transient life has allowed me to collect so few possessions, and I am ready to put down roots. After a moment, Stephanie tips her head to the side and asks,
what will you do about your name?
My name?
Wake. You will keep it, yes?
She always has been a stickler about this, so I wade in carefully. No, I plan to take his.
You will give up your own identity?
Her mouth tightens into a straight line.
Not even Henri Fiocca is worth such a sacrifice.
You are wrong, he is worth it. But honestly, it has nothing to do with identity or sacrifice. But it does have everything to do with loyalty. Her eyes narrow, daring me to defend my position.
Why should I keep my father's name? He abandoned my family when I was two. I've never seen him since, and I owe him no loyalty.
She sniffs.
Then take your mother's maiden name, anything but a man's.
I do laugh then. I can't help it.
My mother's maiden name was given to her by her father. All surnames are male names.
Patriarchal.
Fine, but if I have to pick a patriarch, I'll pick the one I actually like.
I do not agree with your decision, or your logic, she says, but I do not wish to fight.
Stephanie rises from the chair beside my window and walks into the kitchen. She returns with two glasses and a bottle of Remy Martin.
Once more for old times?
And for new beginnings. I reach for the bottle and she surrenders it to me. Her eyes widen when she sees how much I pour into each glass.
Oh,
she says, proudly placing a hand over her heart.
She finally becomes a Parisienne, only to leave Paris.
Henri, July 1939. What do you mean you took care of it? Nancy demands. She has her bare feet up on the balcony rail outside her suite in the Hotel du Louvre-Epée, where she's been living since he finally convinced her to move to Marseille. A half-smoked gitane is in one hand, and their marriage license, properly completed and legalized, sits in her lap. It's clear that she's been pulling at her hair for a good part of the day because it's gone wild, and she looks as though she's been run over by a trolley. Her green eyes are blazing, her mouth set in defiance. But it's the fact that her skirt has slid down her thigh, revealing her slip, that has captured Henri's attention. If she notices, she doesn't care. Nancy takes another angry puff of her cigarette and waits for him to answer. "What I mean?" Henri says, calmly, refilling her wine glass and turning his gaze back to her face, "is that I went to town hall and spoke with him. I took care of it."
"Why bother? He's...
She drifts off, unable to find an appropriately horrible profanity. Nancy taps the ash from her cigarette in frustration.
"I believe the insult you're looking for is fils de pute, and that's exactly what I called him, quite loudly, in fact, when I told him off in the middle of town hall. More than one person stopped to stare."
Henri plucks Nancy's cigarette from her pinched fingers and takes a draw. He grimaces. Smoking is the one filthy habit he never took to. It looks quite sexy on her, however, so he hands it back. He's happy to watch.
"Besides, ma chère, you just called off our engagement. It's not like you left me any choice."
She pouts.
"You know I wasn't serious."
"You sounded serious on the phone."
"I was angry."
"As you had a right to be. That enculé..."
He spits out the word as though it's gristle from an overcooked steak.
"Was toying with you. He hates anyone not from Marseille."
"Why?"
"Because this city is small and insular, fiercely proud of its inhabitants, suspicious of strangers. Besides, he's a friend of Marceline's, has been in love with her for years, though I can't imagine why. I'm certain that entire fiasco was a personal favor to her."
The look on Nancy's face is akin to wonder.
"What does that mean? That word you just used?"
Henri clears his throat.
"It's very bad."
"Clearly, but also effective. That and the other one, fils..."
She snaps her fingers, trying to remember.
"Fils, something or other."
He looks at his shoes, studies the scuff marks on the toes.
"Fils de pute."
"You're embarrassed. Whatever for?"
"It's one thing to say these things to a man in the heat of an argument. It's quite another to say them to my fiancée."
She grins wickedly.
"Perhaps you should teach me to say them myself, so you don't have to. That way, the next time I apply for a marriage license, I can deal with that man on my own."
He snorts.
"There won't be a next time. I intend to keep you all to myself until the very end of my life."
Nancy turns her face to the sun.
"Have you read the papers today? The end of everything, not just our lives, might be coming. They're saying war with Germany is inevitable."
Like most people in France, Henri and Nancy have shut their eyes to the inevitable. Every day the radios crackle with reports of German atrocities. The newspapers declare in bold print that peace talks are falling apart. Meanwhile, France sits at the edge of Europe like a shiny, unclaimed prize. The sense of claustrophobia grows each day as Germany looms ever closer in the north. To the east, Mussolini makes threats. To the west, they are hemmed in by the Atlantic Ocean. And in the south, the formidable Pyrenees separate France from Spain. The entire nation has nowhere to go. So they wait. They live and dance and kiss with the unspoken fear looming around them that this might not just be the last summer before the war, it could also be their last summer altogether. And yet, Nancy has moved to Marseille to be with him. She is here and she is safe. They will be married soon. Henri clings to this, and he clings to her every chance that he gets. Henri thinks for a moment. He does not like how easily she was thwarted by the official at town hall. She is a foreigner living in Marseille. He loves his city, but it can be hard on outsiders. Nancy will be miserable if she's always having to wait on him to rescue her. A vicious vocabulary could give her bargaining tools she wouldn't have otherwise.
Okay, he says finally. I'll teach you to curse like a Frenchwoman.
No, she shakes the cigarette in his face. Teach me to curse like a French man.
My own mother couldn't do that.
Do I look like your mother, Henri Fioca? The corner of his mouth lifts in a wanton grin.
Not in the least.
Just as I thought. She stubs out her gitane. Where do we start?
Henri checks his watch. I have to be back at the office in 20 minutes, so we'll start with three.
I want the bad ones, she says. The ones you just used to describe that man at town hall.
Okay, two bad ones, and one mild, just to ease my conscience.
Poor Henri, the awful things your fiancé makes you do.
His gaze returns to her exposed slip and the length of thigh beyond it. He has to suppress the hungry moan that rises in his throat.
We'll start with the most common word, merde. It can be a noun or an exclamation. It just means shit.
Merde, she says. Nancy practices it a few times, getting used to the way the consonants roll off her tongue.
Henri nods once she's got the pronunciation right.
Now use it in a sentence.
She thinks for a moment. That filthy piece of merde stole my car.
Not bad. But it can also be used in other contexts besides an insult. As a consolation, for example. If I told you my father had just died, you would say,
thank God.
He laughs.
Okay, bad example. We'll go with my mother. And that's true. She died before I was 20.
Nancy is appropriately appalled.
Oh, mad. I'm sorry, Henri.
Well done. But in that context, you draw it out. Make it two syllables. Merde.
She mimics him perfectly. And then, after a moment, when she's certain he isn't in fact upset about his mother, asks,
next? What did you call that man? Fils something or other?
Fils de pute. It's the equivalent of your son of a bitch, but more insulting. It literally means son of a whore and is terribly vulgar, and therefore very effective. It's the sort of thing men say when flinging the finger or grabbing their crotch. It's an insult reserved specifically for people, not as a statement of irritation.
So not the sort of thing you say unless you mean it.
Exactly. Try it.
That fils de pute at town hall was purposefully making my life miserable.
He beams.
Perfect.
She's warming to this lesson.
Next.
Henri runs the pad of his thumb across her lips.
I don't want to taint that pretty mouth of yours.
She snaps at his thumb with her teeth.
A bit light, I'm afraid.
He makes a show of sighing, but really, he's enjoying this. She's taken to the lesson, and filthy as the habit is, it's no less sexy than watching her smoke.
Enculé, he says. It's really the worst word that I know.
Nancy sets her feet on the floor and scoots forward on her chair.
What does it mean?
Sometimes it's harder to say the meaning than the actual word.
He clears his throat. It means one who has been... I believe the English word is buggered.
Oh, I say that all the time.
No, he shakes his head. It's different in French. In English, it's flippant. But in this language, you mean it literally. Enculé. It's something you say to the person you hate most.
Nancy doesn't miss a beat. She offers Henri a waspish smile.
Marceline, la enculé.
The fact that her voice is so pleasant and sweet as she speaks that particular sentence makes the insult spectacular. Henri leans back in his chair and shakes his head a bit in appreciation.
You're a natural.
Nancy rises from her chair and straddles his lap. She places one gentle kiss on his lips. I have an excellent teacher. As always, when she kisses him, Henri is consumed. He glances at his watch. He has only 5 minutes. It's more than enough time to make sure she gets a proper kiss.
Marseille. Hôtel de l'UVP, September 3rd, 1939. Henri set a wedding date of November 30th. I think he did this so as not to alarm me, to give me time, allow me to ease into the idea of being a wife. He insisted there was no rush, but I know this is a statement made only for my benefit. He would most certainly love to rush. He would swan dive into matrimony given the chance. As it stands, however, we take our time. In the interim, I have taken up residence at the Hôtel de l'UVP until our new flat becomes available on the 1st of December. We spend all spring and summer having light, frivolous fun, as though living at the very top of a soap bubble. But now, we have settled into a regular routine, filled with wedding plans and the daily chores needed to build a life together. Henri works his usual long hours, starting at 5 in the morning and ending promptly 12 hours later. He does, however, meet me in the hotel bar for pastis at 11, our favourite pre-lunch pastime, before we wander into the city to find a bistro. And then, once we're stuffed to the gills, he heads back to the office and I to my room upstairs for a nap. My job, once I wake in the early afternoon, is to begin the process of furnishing our flat. I go into the city and meet with retailers. I look at lavish fabric for draperies and upholstery for chairs. I order Persian rugs and a bar for the drawing room. I pick out china patterns, crystal glasses, and flatware, making my orders and instructing everything to be delivered to our new flat the second week of December. I've never set up a home before, and I find the process both maddening and therapeutic. I look up from my table in the corner when Henri walks into the bar, smiling, as always, to see him. He's 15 minutes late today, and there is a sense of urgency to his movements. Turn on the radio, he orders Antoine, and I jump at the sound of his voice, booming and authoritative. Antoine flips it to the BBC French service, and Henri settles into the chair beside me. I look at him but do not ask any questions. His head is bent to the side, listening, as the static gives way to a familiar voice. Neville Chamberlain.
This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently, this country is at war with Germany.
There are only a handful of people in the bar, but each of us draws a long, somber breath. It's not like we didn't know this was coming. Of course we knew. Germany invaded Poland 2 days ago and Chamberlain delivered his ultimatum for withdrawal. The threat of war has been crackling in the air for several years, but hearing it announced is not a thing you are ever prepared for. Henri reaches for my hand, squeezes it. Antoine glances at my face and hands me a napkin. He expects me to cry, and I might. We listen as Chamberlain expresses his dismay with these circumstances, with England's failed efforts to arrange a peaceful and honourable settlement between Germany and Poland. How Hitler has categorically refused these efforts. Chamberlain tells us how Hitler can be stopped only by force. I remember Berlin. I think of him standing there beneath the Blutfahne, the blood banner, and I know that Chamberlain is right. The spilling of blood is the true legacy of Adolf Hitler.
We and France are today, in fulfillment of our obligations, going to the aid of Poland, who is so bravely resisting this wicked and unprovoked attack on her people. We have a clear conscience. We have done all that any country could do to establish peace. The situation in which no word given by Germany's ruler could be trusted, and no people or country could feel themselves safe, has become intolerable. And now that we have resolved to finish it, I know that you will all play your part with calmness and courage.
Antoine returns to his place behind the bar and shifts from one foot to another. Every time his weight goes to his left leg, he winces slightly. Like Henri, he fought in the Great War, and I wonder if he is thinking of fighting again. For the next few moments, Neville Chamberlain gives instructions to those who have joined the civil defense. He encourages his countrymen to carry on with their jobs.
Now, may God bless you all. May he defend the right. It is the evil things that we shall be fighting against: brute force, bad faith, injustice, oppression, and persecution. And against them, I am certain that the right will prevail.
We forget about lunch, about work and shopping, and all the small business that usually fills our days. Henri and I sit in Antoine's bar and listen to the radio as more and more people file in. Antoine hands us each a glass of brandy, and we sip, slowly, listening to the British and then the French read their declarations of war. Sometime later, King George takes to the airwaves.
In this grave hour, perhaps the most fateful in our history, I send to every household of my peoples, both at home and overseas, this message, spoken with the same depth of feeling for each one of you, as if I were able to cross your threshold and speak to you myself. For the second time in the lives of most of us, we are at war. Over and over again, we have tried to find a peaceful way out of the differences between ourselves and those who are now our enemies. But it has been in vain.
I am Australian to the bone, and yes, I have taken on a second life as a Parisienne. France is my home now. But there are the moments when a woman returns to her roots, and the voice of my monarch reminds me that I am, and always will be, a member of the British Empire. I sit up straighter and swallow the emotion that builds in my throat. Henri drapes his arm across my shoulders.
This is the ultimate issue which confronts us. For the sake of all that we ourselves hold dear, and of the world's order and peace, it is unthinkable that we should refuse to meet the challenge. It is to this high purpose that I now call my people at home and my peoples across the seas, who will make our cause their own. I ask them to stand calm, firm, and united in this time of trial. The task will be hard. There may be dark days ahead, and war can no longer be confined to the battlefield. But we can only do the right as we see the right, and reverently commit our cause to God. If, one and all, we keep resolutely faithful to it, ready for whatever service or sacrifice it may demand, then, with God's help, we shall prevail. May he bless and keep us all.
In a moment, just like that, every person in Antoine's bar is struck with the sense that our laughter and our joy will soon turn to tears.
What does this mean? I ask Henri.
His gaze goes soft as he stares at the table.
It means, mon cher, that one day we will remember our friends and count the dead.